Welcome back once again. You're listening to another episode of the Geek Whisperers, where we bring our skills in talking to geeks and enterprise IT folks, and we talk about it. We talk about enterprise IT and social media and community. We've got a really good show today. My name is John Mark Troyer.
And I'm Amy Lewis.
And I'm Matt Brender.
And I'm really excited to have our guest on. Really pleased to bring Lisa Kaywood on the show. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I am Lisa Kaywood. I'm Real Lisa C on Twitter. I am currently a product marketing manager at Brocade. I've been a product marketing manager for a number of years now at various institutions around the Valley. Before that, I had roles in a different form of influencer marketing analyst relations. And before that, I spent the first several years of my career doing channel marketing and channel management.
You've had several different flavors of quote-unquote marketing.
Yes, I have a rather checkered past.
Those are the best kinds.
That's where Matt has to hop in and become a marketing denier.
Nay.
We are all marketers in some way, all of us.
I'm
the technology.
I don't know. I think regular listeners will actually hear this in me, but over the last few episodes, I've been getting closer and closer to admitting that I kind of like marketing. It might be something worth keeping. So I know the world revolves around my opinion on it. So let's get back to you, Lisa. You wrote an incredible blog post about community and even gave a little shout-out connected to Geek Whisperers. Why don't you kind of present that in an abridged version for those that haven't read it yet and just tell us why you wanted to talk to us?
Okay, sure. So the blog was called Communities of the Faithful, and it was actually something that I sort of had parked for 2 or 3 months as the result of a conversation I had with a friend of mine who was originally in enterprise IT and is now at a startup doing SDN stuff. It sort of got reignited by a couple of different other blog posts and sort of debates that happened in the community. One had to do with the enduring value of certain types of certifications, and the other one had to do with vendor-hosted communities, ambassador programs, or I think they go by various names, and what the people in those programs get out of them and what they have to be careful about and balance. I was looking at all of those things together, coming out of the earlier discussion I'd had with my friend, as not indiscrete things, but things that we as vendors tend to use to make our position with our customers stickier. When we talk about the sales process or we talk about selling to customers, especially in technology, we tend to talk all about product features and how cool the product is, and that's what we sell on verbally. What is really going on behind the scenes for everybody involved is not just how cool the product is, but there's a whole host of other factors that go into the decision-making process about, do I buy a particular vendor? Do I stay with a particular vendor? And why or why not? The funny thing about tech in general and tech sales in particular is that everybody likes to pretend they're super, super objective. Now, the fact of the matter is that humans are not always completely when they make decisions. Decision making is something like an iceberg where sort of the top 20% shows, and that's the part where we're conscious of and we make very logical decisions about it. But then there's that 80% that's sort of beneath the waterline that is the emotional aspects of decision making, whether it's hope, whether it's fear, whether it's greed, any number of those other things that kind of go into the decision making process that people are more or less conscious of depending on who they are. Recognizing that and understanding that and out how to deal with it and help the decision maker deal with that part of the decision-making equation is really what the softer side of sales is all about. And these certification programs, the all kind of part of that softer side of sales. And so that's really where I was going with the blog post, is understanding that role in the sales process and in the customer relationship process.
I think that there's a lot of deep wisdom there. I think we probably can just say goodbye. No, Lisa, that was fabulous. I totally agree with you. It's also about doing business with people you like, and that's a lot of some of what we do. We add a human element to the online component of the business. But
absolutely,
as a further data point, right? Us techies like to make fun of golf games and whatever the salespeople do to do business, but I take people out for drinks, and we have the expert programs, and we do these podcasts, and we hang out together too. We socialize in a geeky way, just like the business folks socialize over playing golf and whatever else.
Beer and bacon is geek golf.
Yeah.
There you go.
So Lisa, does that make the relationships that we're fostering through community seem like inherently part of the sales cycle?
Yes, it is. And that's why vendors host these programs. That's the ROI that you go show your executives. That's not to say that the people in the programs do not benefit from them as well. Typically, salespeople are trained to think in sort of almost adversarial or predator and prey sorts of terms. And oftentimes, their customers feel that way as well. But I think these are programs where it, in some sense, changes that equation a little bit, where the customer really is getting something personally out of the relationship. It's not just, yes, come extract money from me. They're getting something personally out of it as well. So the reason these things are as effective as they are is because there is value for the individual, as well as I'm getting a box or a piece of software or a widget that is going to solve my technical problem.
That also strikes me as true. And if I can mischaracterize our brethren over in PR, they often have a more traditional adversarial relationship with the journalists and analysts that they work with. They would say absolutely not. They are partners with these people. They're trying to help them do their jobs. But there often is a pitch and a get, you know, oh, I got that. I managed to land a story in the Wall Street Journal, or, you know, I did a pitch. What I like about what we do over here on the community side and on the influence marketing side is I explicitly don't really pitch people. I help them, right? What I loved about a podcast we just recently did with Daryl Swager was he is a marketer and he does demand gen and he does all the things that marketers do, but he is explicitly customer focused. He's like, I defend customers against the community at some level.
Your comment about PR pitching people I've actually had this conversation with my PR counterparts, where at one point they came to me and said, hey, you have these relationships with these bloggers. We'd like to invite them to an event. Would you reach out to them and invite them for us? My first reaction was kind of you. And I sat there and I thought about it for a bit. And I went back to them and I said, I'm not comfortable with that. That's not the relationship I want to have with these people. I want to be able to just be able to sit down and have an interesting conversation with them and not have them cringe and have the defensive walls go up every time they see me coming because I'm going to be pitching them. Would you guys mind being the bad guys? And fortunately, the PR people that I work with are also on Twitter and they understand those dynamics. And they were like, okay, yes, I get that. And they understood that there was value in having those differentiated roles. And so they've taken that on. And so we've had that separation of duties and it's worked really well. Part of the reason it works well is because some bloggers also sort of function as pundits. Some of them write for trade publications and so forth. And sometimes they are functioning in a PR type of relationship with the vendors that they work with. And so it's appropriate in those cases to go and pitch them in a PR type of manner.
Oh, yeah, sure. Or invite them to an event.
Or invite them to an event, right?
It's a win-win situation. They want to come to the event. They get to feel special. They are special. Not very many people got invited to the event. They also gives them fodder for their blog to write up.
And that's where I was going to jump in, stir the pot a little bit here is I don't disagree with what you're saying. I think that differentiation and not being sleazy is key. But I think conveying authenticity and not becoming the person who's always pitching something is the way that you open doors. And it's back to the authenticity as part of the influence diet of get up, dress up, show up. And I think coming over and over and over again and being yourself is a big part of that. And there are different ways to do it. Role differentiation could be one way. But I have been surprised repeatedly when I think, oh, I don't know. And just go to the bloggers that I'm talking to and say, look, this opportunity came up. What do you think? And letting them decide and sort of lead has always surprised me in terms of sometimes I thought, well, I'm protecting them from this hideousness. Whenever I framed it in that way of like, I'm not sure, but I'm putting this in your hands and here are the caveats and doubts that I have, it's turned out okay.
You know, and this is something that role differentiation is something I can do because I work in a sort of medium size. You don't really have that choice most of the time. I think that's where having a really broad-based culture of engagement within the company is really, really, really important. So it's, again, you don't have the one person who is always being the pitch master. You have everybody who is out in the community engaged with everybody else. And so if something comes up that happens to pertain to one particular person's area of expertise or whatever they're working on that they want to go talk to people about, they can just say, hey, by the way, you know, we were talking about X last week. I've been working on something that's related to that. That's why I was interested in the conversation. you know, we're at a point where we can talk a little bit more about it. Should we set up some time? And that's something that they can do because they've fostered that trust relationship, but they're not always pitching, right? There are exactly. people who are working on stuff and they have a rich, broad relationship with the people already.
No, I agree with this. The one thing I'm thinking whenever you're talking initially about how does this start? How do we have communities of the faithful? Those kinds of relationships are a key element, though, to building brand loyalty. We may not want to talk about it. It may be the B word. But our relationships with people and that community surrounding a brand, the culture any brand has created, have a real strong impact on our feeling about the brand. And we can say we don't have religion about one thing or the other, but just throw into any tech conversation, you know, Mac versus, you know, the phone war, right? Just what phone do you have in your hand? And you can start a war instantly in a bar. So.
Well, Lisa, you guys in your team at Brocade have done a few tech field days. And we had Stephen Foskett on a few episodes back and we talked about tech field day. And I'm a big fan. Can you talk a little bit about why you all decided to do that? Were you worried about the loss of control of this live streamed event with bloggers that may or may not be friendly with you, and what you learned from it, and what do you think the effects were of it?
So one of the reasons that I was attracted to coming to Brocade was because it was sort of at this pivotal moment in its history where it was really transitioning from being an OEM-based company to a true B2B company. That goes back to Brocade's heritage as a fiber channel company that is now moving into Ethernet space. Part of that transition has meant, you know, I was coming into this very pivotal moment. When I came in, social media was almost non-existent at Brocade. It was not formally part of my job in any way, shape, or form. It was just something I happened to do anyway. When I saw the opportunity to do this, I kind of had to sell it internally. And people weren't really sure what we were going to get out of it. I wouldn't say that there was fear or loss of control so much as just, well, what do we get out of it? And, you know, there was some question of, you know, do we get sales leads? What is this thing? I said, think of it as PR. It's building awareness. Okay. What came back, you know, in terms of the tweets during the event and blog posts and so forth were enough to sell people on, oh, hey, you know, they got us. They saw what we were doing and they liked it. And that's cool. And so I have been very, very careful to document all of those things after every event that we do, because it helps maintain the funding and the machinery and so forth. That's not what I personally get out of it, and I don't think that's the real value to Brocade, but that's how I sell it internally. For me, from my point of view, the real value is I have met all these really cool, interesting, forward-looking and forward-thinking people. It is a starting point in a relationship that I maintain every day. Many of these people are people who've become personal friends. Collectively, they have influenced me probably at least as much, if not more, as I have influenced them. What I really get out of those conversations and those relationships is I get a front row seat on the collective body of customer thought in a way that when you sit at headquarters in this little bubble of Silicon Valley, it becomes very, very, very hard. And you can say, well, you know, you have customer contact through EBC and sometimes through customer advisory boards. But in the EBC context, people are coming through and they're doing their listening tour of Silicon Valley. And while they're in the EBC, they're mostly looking at their laptops and doing email.
For folks that don't know, EBC is Executive Briefing Center. It's our jargon.
Yes. Sorry. So they come through and you do your pitch and they may or may not ask any questions at all. And to the degree that they do, they're being very selective about what they tell you about what they're interested in.
But if you follow those exact same people on Twitter, you'll see their exact thoughts are like, ugh, another storage system or ugh, another thing like this. So I think there's also
a
candidness to the platforms that you can leverage.
Exactly. And it's not just about the product and what they think of the product. I mean, you know, most of the time we're not discussing any particular product or the particular feature or anything else. It's what do I think of vendor X, Y, or Z? Or I hate salespeople because they do X. Or I really need help understanding blah. And those are the things that are really valuable to understand as a marketer, because that's what really tells you what people need. And it's not just let me go fix this need so I can sell people more stuff. Because, you know, if you help them understand a particular, let's say, virtualization concept or storage concept, that doesn't mean they're necessarily going to buy your product. But you can provide a service to the community where you're sort of helping lift all boats, right? And that's good for everybody. It helps build perhaps brand loyalty in a different kind of way. And as I say, it's not about your product. It's just you're giving back to the community and people begin to recognize that there's some value in talking to you.
Yeah, it's not your product. It's your reputation even.
Exactly. It's about reputation.
And that is brand. And again, I know it's an interesting thing. We've sort of walked around it a little bit and it's so markety to talk about. But if there were a Myers-Briggs test of marketing, brand is so the feeling and perceptive quadrants, don't you think? And all these things contribute, not in a bad way. I mean, the last thing you want is your brand to be your corporate brand to be, we punch people in the face. We want that positive feeling. It's not a scary negative thing, even if we're looking at the machinations of how we would like to influence how it came out.
Yeah, absolutely. And to go back to that analogy of the iceberg and understanding what's beneath the surface, a lot of time people themselves are not aware of what's beneath the surface. And if you're an incumbent, that's okay. You'd kind of rather keep it that way. And so you quietly feed all of those emotions that are beneath the surface, hopefully without anybody noticing that you're doing them and not calling attention to that, because that maintains your position. If you're a new entrant in a space, it's often very helpful both to you and to your customer to kind of draw out what's beneath the surface there. What are sort of the operating assumptions that they're working on that they themselves may not really be totally aware of? And if you kind of bring those out into the light, and help them understand that that really is part of their decision-making process, and make sure that they're comfortable with that they're factoring in everything and really making the most optimal decision that's really going to work for them, both on the spreadsheet as well as everything else that they hope to get out of the decision-making process. You are, again, providing a service because you're helping them do a really holistic analysis of what they're trying to do. And at the same time, it's a way of really challenging some perhaps unwritten and unconscious assumptions that people are operating on.
So here's the funny thing, Lisa, and this is a little bit of a joke. If a social media person does that, sometimes an executive will come back and say, well, what are the metrics around that?
Yeah. I have no metrics for anything I do.
All right, well, I'm done here then. I got to go.
We've hit Matt's hot button.
Well, no, it's tough. It is really qualitative stuff, and I think it's super important stuff. I have some metrics conversations going on right now, not around this area. I'm struggling with some of these same issues. You know, what could you even measure? And if you measured it, you shouldn't want to even optimize towards it. But
it gets back to we know there are very complex measurements in terms of people talk about brand health. So you know that the good people at, say, Coca-Cola have got this down. I wonder if, as seedy as this seems, is that a conversation that we need to think about? What does it mean, and how does the community impact?
Sure, you could do surveys. You could do surveys. You could do net promoter scores. I mean, you can measure all this stuff if you really wanted to. I don't know how meaningful it is.
I wonder about time spent measuring versus good horse sense and going out and doing the work.
Yeah, let's take a huge step back real quick and realize that a big part of what Lisa presented as she was discussing, like, why she and the team got involved in Tech Field Day, was that she documented all the blog posts and all the kind of buzz that was happening on different platforms. You said it yourself, you're directly comparing yourself as like a PR idea. This is brand awareness. This is not something that's going to directly get you into the sales funnel. And if you know how those PR people measure success, you measure against them and see if you're as successful and for the right price. And it works like a charm.
Well, and also, it's deeper than that, Matt. Lisa's a product person. So she's also using that as input to product, the next rev of the product and things like that.
Oh, definitely, definitely. But I'm thinking from a pure investment standpoint of, if you're thinking about metrics, you have to think about who's measuring from what direction. And if you're talking about brand awareness, that really comes down to you're kind of internally competing or collaborating, depending on your org chart, with PR, AR. Versus the product management, I think there's another kind of warm, fuzzy metric that you can use there, like the customer stories that end up as part of your product build scenario, like talking about what people are doing with their data center and why that's important. That's absolutely pivotal to building a good product, and I'm sure Lisa considers that.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been talking a lot about, you said warm, fuzzy, a lot of about feelings and emotions and all of that, but there's sort of on the other side of the fence. And again, product managers, being techies, don't like to think about this and don't like to admit it most of the time, but they are very personally invested in the products that they bring to market because they have to fight and battle and to get this or that feature and get it out the door. And so it can be very hard for them to hear that their baby is ugly. it can be very hard for them to hear that it's just simply not going to be useful to somebody. There can be a tendency sometimes for people to sort of hear what they want to hear, particularly if their interactions with the customers or other people outside is sort of in the construct of, you know, a briefing or something like that, where everybody's being polite. Because I'm not personally invested in the way they are, I can actually listen in a very dispassionate way.
I just want to stop and like make sure that point really hits home with everyone. That's a moment to use this as that space and almost the vulnerability of a product manager with skin in the game to come out and be told their baby's ugly. It starts to shed some light on why there might be pushback against those tactics. As we talk to our practitioners, you know, and you're thinking about bringing some of these tactics into your own practice, that vulnerability you said of when you get that sort of outside feedback in, it can be really hard to hear. So sorry, didn't want to interrupt your flow. I just thought that was incredibly important.
Yeah. You know, as I say, because I'm not personally invested, I can just sit there and listen all day long about why I hate vendor X, Y, or Z, or what's really driving them up a wall about either a particular product or a particular problem that they're having. And I can take that back and I can just lay it all out and go, here's what I'm hearing. And we can have those conversations internally. Again, product managers, because of their role, seem to tend to think of everything in terms of, well, I need to add this feature, that feature. But, you know, a lot of the time, it's not about the feature. It's about, do we need to build better education around this product? What do we need to help people understand about this product to make them more comfortable about embracing it? That's marketing, that's education, that might be professional services, it might be better training the field. And helping everybody understand that it's not just about the product and it's not just about the feature, I think helps us build a better offer and a more useful offer, a more meaningful offer to customers. And you don't get that if you're focused on the product and sort of defending the turf that you've defined for that product.
That's an interesting, it's a very receptive stance. It's a listening stance and it's a collaborative stance. I love all that.
Absolutely.
Thinking about how these tactics sit incumbent in the marketplace versus a newcomer, and which one of those variables, if we have a multivariate test going on, which one of those do you move back and forth? It sounds like companies of different sizes and companies of different maturity in the marketplace have something to learn here from these tactics.
I've done that in large companies and in smaller companies. The sort of the listening aspect is, I think, sort of irrespective of size. I think that where the size comes in is really more in terms of, do you construct a formal program of ambassadors, whatever you want to call them? For a mid-tier or smaller company, that's probably not appropriate unless you have a really, really rabid fan base. Because what you're really fighting for if you're a smaller company is just for people to realize that you exist and that you have interesting stuff. You're not fighting for dominance and preserving a position in the market. On the outbound side, it's kind of different tactics, but I think everybody can be and should be thinking in the inbound side of, what can I really learn from the market from these very candid kinds of channels and conversations that I can have with people? I am far more likely to trust a conversation that I have in the social space as being valid and relevant and true than any conversation I have sitting in the briefing center. Because when people come to the briefing center, they're coming in with a specific agenda, and it's the predator-prey relationship, and it's everybody's got their game face on.
I feel like you just broke marketing.
Well, actually,
it wouldn't be the first time.
To play devil's advocate real quick, I mean, you actually, it kind of helped isolate us further in the social community world. If we position ourselves as that which is more authentic than what the traditional marketer is doing, inviting companies in and having behind closed doors conversation, I can just see those that are at all have some antibodies of resistance in them just totally flaring up and pushing it off and saying, this is stupid. It's not true.
But Matt, so what Lisa said, if I can put words into her mouth, is not that the conversation necessarily was happening in public, but that we've all taken off our game faces and it's a person-to-person conversation rather than a company-to-company conversation. And it could happen in private, but it's just more authentic because we're not here on a sales call or we're not here on a briefing call.
You all know me.
Yeah, I mean, the stakes are low, right?
Yeah, I'm more inclined to agree than disagree. I'm just simply saying from somebody that isn't already drinking our Kool-Aid here, that sounds like a tough thing to sell.
All right, well, I'm going to be devil's advocate number two. The minute marketers hear about this, we all know they're going to rush in and say, how can we do this? How can we imitate authenticity? How can we create, it's like Bacos.
And then how do we measure authenticity?
Right. It's like Bacos, right?
Damn it.
It tastes like bacon. It's close enough.
Well, so, you know, I should maybe provide a little bit of context here for why I do this the way I do. I mentioned at the beginning these sort of earlier roles that I had before I moved into product marketing. And there were always these sort of genus kinds of roles where, on the one hand, I was representing my company's interests out into a specific constituency, the channel or the industry analyst or what have you. But at the same time, everybody understood that my job was also to represent that constituency's interests back into the company. And when I moved into product marketing, the toughest thing that I had to deal with in making that transition was the fact that all of a sudden I felt like I had been shut in solitary confinement and there wasn't even a light, because all of a sudden I was cut off from the outside world. And I was just, you know, in headquarters in our little bubble, and I only talked to other product marketers and product managers who, of course, were in many cases hearing what they wanted to hear. Then I was supposed to construct meaningful messaging that was going to resonate with the customer. And I'm like, how is this going to work? As I say, I felt blind. I felt like my arms and legs had been cut off. When I punched through that little the wall and got a little chink in and saw some sunlight again through the vehicle of social media, that was where I, again, felt like I had a connection with the outside world again. For me personally, you know, a lot of the time if I'm working through ideas or how it makes sense to talk about something in a way that is going to be meaningful to people, I kind of work it through in social first, because I can do it in my own words, in my own voice, and I'm getting the immediate feedback of, does this make sense? Does it grab people? Does it make people stop and think or ask questions? Does it provoke a conversation? Do people go, that's stupid? I do a lot of that in the social space. I'm not saying I'm testing my message here. It's just, you know, I'm working out my ideas, and I bring that back to formal collateral that winds up in a PDF somewhere that nobody ever reads, but it makes internal people happy.
Well, I'm even more blatant about it. I refer to it as geek sourcing. I 100% go out
absolutely
and ask it questions, because I don't presume that I have the best language or the right way in. And if you want to know how it's going to resonate with the audience, what amazing tools to say, you know, hey, what do you think about A or B? It ends up with, I learn every time. So regardless if I'm able to influence the outcome, what a great process. I love that analogy. We can see that crack of daylight into a customer base, no matter where you sit.
Yeah.
And I really hate the whole notion of the sort of predator-prey relationship. I hate it. I hate it with a passion. For me personally, for marketing to be meaningful and for it to be a valid way to be spending my life, I have to be giving something that is useful to people. I have to be helping them understand whether or not this particular product is going to suit their needs. I'm not going to go out there and tell you that my product is the best thing ever and is going to solve your problem in every single instance, no matter what. That's not who I am. And that was kind of another challenge that I had when I moved into product marketing, is that I sort of felt like I was supposed to do unquestioning evangelism. And that's just not who I am. I am a questioner. I have to poke at things to get myself comfortable that this really is the right thing. And so I kind of take it apart and I kind of go, well, this is useful for this and this is useful for this, yes or no. And I kind of test that out. And so that's part of my process as well, to get comfortable that I understand what's really going to be helpful and meaningful to people. Talking through specific aspects, not even, again, necessarily related to my product, but just sort of conceptually, is this useful? Is this valuable? What would make it more or less valuable with people out who actually use this stuff? That's critically important for me to be comfortable that I'm bought in. It's not just, you know, toss it over to Lisa and she'll go shout about it to people. That process doesn't work for me. So to me, you know, as I say, the people that we work with out in the community influence me as much or more as I influence them. And I think that's as it should be, to be totally honest. I think that as vendors, we kind of tend to be locked away in our own little worlds and don't listen as well as we could or should. And that's very much to our detriment, and it's to our customers' detriment.
Yeah. It's nice when we turn the microphone around and let the shouting come from outside of our world instead of toward people. But it's even better when there's a real, you know, dyadic conversation happening through whatever medium we have. So I think we're all a fan of that.
This has been an extraordinarily valuable conversation for me, Lisa. So I want to thank you for those insights. I am sitting here at VMware, and VMware was a smaller company, and now is a you know, it's still not as big as you know, an EMC or a Cisco or whatever. We were always kind of the leader of this space. We changed people's lives. We always had these rabid fans, and people bet their careers on us early. So we have the vExperts. It's a big army of people. They are not always advocates of VMware, but they certainly are knowledgeable, and they, again, there's that win-win relationship with them. People from other companies have come to me over the years and have asked me, how do we do what you do? How do we make a vExpert program? How do we make an advocacy program? How do I get these rabid followers like this? My first answer is, well, be VMware? You know, that's really not a good answer for them, right? You know, no, they can't be VMware, and they shouldn't be VMware, even if they tried. It's been very difficult, especially for companies that are either smaller or startups or mid-market companies that are trying to start their community program or start their influencer marketing program. It's been difficult for me. And one of the light bulbs that went off in my mind today was that I need to go back and ask them, why are you doing this? What is your expectation to get out of it? If you're just expecting to be like the movie 300 and give people spears and send them out like the Spartan army, that's probably not what's going to happen for this company at this stage with the particular products that you have. But if you think of it from an inbound perspective, like you said, the listening perspective, you might be very rich after we develop this program. And maybe you won't have an army, maybe you won't have a giant cathedral, but you know, you'll have a very nice little what's smaller than a cathedral? A cult, home church.
A yurt. You know? A yurt. A yurt.
Even at a small level, you can gather a community of the faithful, or at least people who are love to eat at your restaurant, right? Even if they're not going to sign up as your army. An interesting juxtaposition.
I think that the thinking that you're describing is, again, sort of PR first mentality. And what I would say to that is, you don't get rabid fans out of creating a community. You create a community out of rabid fans. You have to have rabid fans to begin with before you can begin thinking about that community. You can bring yourself into a community that already exists out in the bigger, broader world and become part of that community, working as peers with people out in the community. And that's very much how I prefer to think of my engagement with other people in the community is, look, I'm here to learn from you as much as anything else. How can we serve you better? And if you do that, the give and take that comes out of that is extremely rich. And it may be that at some point, people sort of begin to become fans of you, and then maybe you can build that, you know, sort of ambassador program and formalize it. But in that case, you're formalizing something, a groundswell of sentiment that already exists. It's not something that you can come down from on high, least of all as a challenger, and say, ta-da, we have now created an army of rabid fans. They don't just come magically out of thin air.
I agree with that. And one of the things I've been thinking about here is there is power. And again, this may be the inside baseball moment here, but, and John taught me this trick, there is power to giving community a name. It may seem like it commodifies it to the external user, and that's certainly not the intent. Sometimes when we give those ambassadors who are already functioning and we don't wish for them to function any differently, when you give them a name and talk about them collectively, when they become a collective noun, then the powers that be internally listen. And you may open ears for the first time where they don't think about bloggers as a group of people running about in their pajamas, but rather they start to think about them in some sort of, again, collective force. I've certainly used the term citizen analyst. If that's the general term, as opposed to maybe you've got the name, maybe you have an ambassador program, I think it gives you power within a larger company. And externally, if you have a smaller company, I've seen this too in people who are new to the space or are smaller in size. If they have a formalized program, you know, John had used the phrase before, punch above your weight. That's the impact I've seen that happen. So somebody goes, oh, company X has an ambassador program. I didn't realize they were that big to have that already. It's interesting, the psychology of it. Names matter and words matter. Those are some of the reasons I've chosen to do some of the things I've done in my career to put these things together in a way that people who don't live and breathe in the community can understand.
Amy, it's also important to dance with them that brung you, right? I see a lot of smaller companies wanting to ignore the people they're already engaged with because they've got their eyes on bigger fish. As much as I'm not a fan of Donald Rumsfeld, right? You got to go to war with the army that you've got, not the army you wish you.
Yep, well
and,
said.
And I'm using war metaphors. So not.
We're not talking predator-prey, John. We're not talking about adversarial relationships here.
It's a metaphor, Lisa. It's a metaphor. I'm a pacifist.
You go to war with the coral reef you have.
You have a lemonade stand. You have people lining up in front of you buying your lemonade. Instead of talking to them and making them your best customers and making them your fans, you look over at the steak restaurant across the street and you start to pitch those people going into the steak restaurant. And they're not your customers and they're not interested in being your customers yet. And you're not even selling something that they want because they're all dressed up for a steak dinner. And you ignore the line of people buying your lemonade. And so I think I see some smaller companies doing that right there. You work with the people that are already interested in your product and start from there. I don't know, Matt, you've seen both sides of the street in your short career.
See, Lisa had a bet on who would make the first age group note for me. And John, it looks like you won.
But you know, you've seen both sides of the table, right? You've worked at a bigger company, now you're at a smaller company. How does it feel not to have all that attention on you? And do you feel like you're kind of screaming for attention?
It's strange. I will be very honest and say it's strange. I think you just captured it very, very well, John, that there is this constant reminder, like, all right, do we treat the people that are already in line really well? Or are we looking at the steak dinner people in your metaphor? I think if you ask different people, it ends up different places and at different companies at different times. And I think the more than gentle reminder to pull it back and focus on creating that passionate group, like Lisa's mentioning, like create a product first off that's worth being passionate about. Secondly, inspire those.
That's the first thing. Yeah.
Yeah. We kind of skipped over that, but it's a big assumption that the product's actually worth being excited about. And then get people excited. Either by joining communities and pulling people in or by taking those that already purchased you and making a community out of that. I think you hit it on the head. There isn't a single formula for small companies, and I think that's a really big part of the excitement of technology right now. We have a lot of personal brand overlapping with corporate brand, startups, and multi-billion dollar companies all playing in the same space, and one doesn't necessarily win every time. So who the hell knows?
The one other thing I would say is, you know, we've been talking about communities focused around and organized around social media, but there are other types of communities, and I think that they will become more and more prominent and relevant as much of the infrastructure world begins to embrace open source as the software world has. And that's really kind of more of a technical community, whether it's self-help, whether it's people identifying bugs, any number of those kinds of things that happen. You sort of have to set up the garden for people to play in and give them the tools, set up the swing set, but then let them go. The term community manager in those contexts is not about social media. It's about enabling the technical interactions and help and self-help and community help and feedback to the vendor, whether it's about bugs or about feature needs or those kinds of things. Those are the kind of communities where you really do start to build really rabid fans. There could be a social component to that in terms of tools used. But that's a different thing, again, than expecting people to go evangelize for you. That could be the nucleus for a small company for where you grow those rabid fans and where you grow that community. And again, that sort of community is something that is primarily focused on giving value to the customer and enabling the customer and giving them tools to be successful. And I really think that as vendors, we kind of tend to be wrapped up in our own agendas, and customers are this entity that we go and attack and figure out how to pry into, as opposed to partners that we're trying to serve. Especially as we move to a more open source world, we really need to shift that mindset to more of a peer-to-peer kind of relationship. And if technical communities help foster that mentality, great, because everything else will come along with it.
Yeah. Oh, super relevant, Lisa. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I would want to talk for another hour with you about this, but maybe we can have you back on. Everything you said is true. There's even elements. We're not even really social media here. We say we are, but we don't really do social media. We use social media. I think about community all the time, obsessively, in fact, and I am very interested in how developers use community versus how IT uses community, the roles of vendors. Open source, online versus offline, we really shouldn't be even in the online portion of a company. This is an offline and online relationship we have with people. There's a whole rich vein of stuff we could mine here, but we probably should leave that for another episode of the Geek Whispers. But Lisa, thank you so much. This has been so insightful. You are super smart and super articulate. And you can tell that your checkered past has served you really well, because I actually learned a whole lot this last little episode. So thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me.
If people want to talk to you more about this sort of thing or learn more about what you guys are doing, where can they reach you?
Again, Real Lisa C on Twitter. My corporate blog is on the Brocade Communities. My non-corporate blog is theborgqueen.wordpress.com. Those are all good ways to reach me.
Great. Well, once again, you've been listening to this episode of the Geek Whispers. If you like what you heard, go ahead and give us a review or a thumbs up or 5 stars or something. Tell some friends about it. We really enjoy talking to our listeners. So please give us a shout out if you can. We're anywhere that you can find us. Thanks again. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to the Geek Whisperers podcast, where we bring social media and community to enterprise IT. You can listen to all the episodes at our website, geek-whisperers.com, or check us out on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. Your hosts were John Mark Troyer, Amy Lewis, and Matthew Brender, better known on Twitter as Jay Troyer, Comms Ninja, and MJ Brender. See you next week.